Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, y'all. My name is Palmer. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. If you detect a hint of an accent that doesn't sound like Miami, you'd be right. I came via Oklahoma on my way to Miami. So I came into this fellowship March 5th of 1990, and I'm so absolutely grateful for that time, as is my family and everybody else. My home group is the Kendall Stepping Up group. And so if you're in Florida, we meet Thursday night. Please come visit us. We do the steps and just have a great time. I also attend an open AA meeting every week. I have a committed open AA meeting because sponsorship has taught me to go to AA as well. That's at the Sable Palm Group in Miami on Sunday afternoon. I'm grateful for AA. I'm grateful that, I mean, AA literally saved my life. And I can't ever pay that debt back except to when AA asks, say yes. And so I'm really grateful that you're allowing me to share your podium. Thank you. It is an honor and a privilege to be able to do that. I also have to thank Brett and Rhonda for hosting. They've been great hosts. And Madeline, and where are you? Somewhere up here. And I've got some friends over here that said they're going to throw rocks. So if you see some rocks flying up here, they said it's going to be done in love. And I want to thank the tapers. You know, I have a drive to work every day, and I know that our tapers work hard, and they carry the message in a way that is unique. And I thank I thank God for them every day when I'm driving, because I arrive to work a more serene and a more serene person than I would be if I were just watching traffic. So I thank them. I don't know how I came to Al-Anon. I grew up in a home that was, I was loved. My family, my parents loved me. My sisters loved me. I wasn't supposed to be born, and I arrived, and they took care of me. I had all my needs met and then some. We weren't lacking in finances, and it was a great place to grow up. In northern New Mexico, and yet that's not what I heard. I have a disease of perception, and I heard that I was alone and different and lonesome and no good. My parents were brilliant physicists, and I don't use that term lightly. They were physicists in the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and my sister was brilliant. I have this. Somebody mentioned Keith Lewis earlier, and I had a sister like Keith's brother, Dumb Danny. My sister. She graduated from high school 3 years early, and she was she went to one college and graduated. I mean, and then she went on to graduate school and got a PhD and has worked at one job. I don't know how you do that. I mean, my God, I can't do that. I was the stupid one. I heard all of my teachers say, "Why can't you be like her?" On inventory, I realized none of them ever said that to me. That was just the message I heard, because I don't hear right. I filter it through my perceiver. So I was the stupid one in this family growing up. And it was as if the week before I was to be born, I was with, meeting with God, and everybody was supposed to hear directions for how to get on and living, and I'd run the bathroom, and I came back, and God was saying, "And that's everything you have to know when you're on earth." I missed the instruction set. I didn't know how to do anything with you. I was afraid. I was steeped in fear. I couldn't be in a room with five people and talk. And I was uncomfortable in my own skin. And I just had this hole in my gut that I just couldn't fill. And I didn't know I didn't know how to fit. I didn't know how to exist in my own skin. You know, I don't know. I just uncomfortable. And so I waited around until I was about 13 and met up with a bunch of guys down in my basement before a church meeting, and we got drunk. I had my first drink. And you know, they say that most normal people don't remember the first drink. I remember my first drunk, and it was, I'm the Al-Anon speaker. I tried it because these guys said, here, come join us, and I don't know how to say no, so I did it. And I woke up the next morning, the magic didn't happen. What Jennifer described as the magic of that drunk didn't happen for me because I don't have the allergy. I woke up in the morning hungover and had to go to church miserable. And, my friends in AA say, Palmer, you can work through that. You got to try a little harder. You can get to the good stuff. But it didn't work. I just had to stay that uncomfortable with the hole in my gut. And, I decided I'm a geographical guy. I graduated from high school. I was sophisticated. I knew I was worldly. A friend of mine got busted for a lid of a pot. I knew the pot was marijuana. I was sophisticated. I just couldn't figure out why he kept it in a jar top instead of they got these Glad bags. Why not use that, And I don't know. I mean, I was just a kid from a protected environment. I didn't know what the world was. And so I went across country and went to college in Portland, Oregon. And I fell in with a crowd of guys, we drank. It was the 70s. We did inhale. That's part of my story. The first couple of weeks I was there, a guy handed me a cigarette with hash in it. First time I'd ever had a cigarette. First time I'd ever had a drug. And so, I got really sick from the cigarette, but I was really into it from the hash, I didn't know how to say no. People would hand me stuff and I'd say, well, sure, because maybe I would be okay with you. So I spent a lot of time in the honky tonks, a lot of time in bars and pubs and drinking with people and chasing that dream of being comfortable with you. And there's always another person on the table with me. Always another person. And maybe if I did that, I would be okay with you. It didn't work. So after 2 years, college just wasn't working for me. It took me 30 years to get through college too, Jennifer, and so, I moved to Haight-Ashbury, and the call of she was going down to Haight-Ashbury and a random she, and I decided, well, yeah, I'm going too. And so I went down to Haight-Ashbury and I was a hippie in Golden Gate Park and doing all that. I had my hair down my back and long beard and doing the things that hippies do, but it seems as though everywhere I go, there I am. And things weren't right in Haight-Ashbury. This was wrong or that was wrong. And I could make a list. And basically it was just that I suffer from a spiritual malady and I just can't exist wherever I am. And so I left Haight-Ashbury and went to New Mexico and joined a commune. And so I was living in a commune in New Mexico again and doing that deal. And that was okay because my mom was dying of cancer in the hospital in Albuquerque. And so I'd go from the commune and hop a freight train down, go to Albuquerque and sit with her and then leave. And after a while, it's just New Mexico wasn't working for him again. Clancy describes it the best I've ever heard. It's like somebody snuck in at night and starts tightening up a spring. And I just get tighter and tighter and more uncomfortable. And I just can't be there where I am. And so I went down to the hospital. I said, Mom, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I've got to go. And we left and went to Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we're going to study there. But for us, study was just being hippies on the beach and doing what we were doing as hippies. And you can fill in the blanks. It's outside issues and stuff. I'm selfish and self-centered. I'm selfish and self-centered. I'm leaving Mom and she's dying and I'm going off looking for whatever it is I'm looking for at the time. I got a call from the state police. They came down and found me and which isn't a good thing when you're doing what hippies do on the beach, but they found me and said, call home. And I called home and my family was just coming in from my mom's funeral. You know, I wasn't there. I wasn't a brother. I wasn't a son. I wasn't a nephew. I just wasn't there because I was off chasing the dream. And, you know, that will come back up later in my story, but I carry a lot of guilt for that. And I didn't understand that I was selfish and self-centered. I didn't know that was the root of my problem. I didn't know. I just knew that somewhere out there, something will fix me. Something's got to be able to fix me because I just couldn't live in my own skin. And, you know, I tell my story this way because, I mean, we haven't even talked about alcoholism yet. I don't know if you say it up here, but I hear people in a lot of areas of the country saying, you know, my qualifier and talking about why we're in alcohol. I understand what they're saying, but I also understand that I am my qualifier. I marry alcoholic women because I qualify for Al-Anon. I don't qualify for Al-Anon because I marry alcoholic women. I'm just crazy on my own. And I think that that's why I'm here. You know, that's why I have a home here. So anyway, I moved back to New Mexico to take care of the house my mom I was taking care of closing it up and everything, and I was a street musician and a potter, and I was playing music in this coffee house for the younger. That's not Starbucks, although it's not a lot different. I mean, we didn't have internet. It was dark. We played chess and smoked cigarettes and played music. And I was playing music, and she walked in. Now, if you're an Al-Anon, you know what I'm talking about. When she walked in, she got my attention immediately. So I closed down after two songs, and I went over to talk to her, and we began a courtship. 5 minutes later, we moved in together. My grandsponsor says, after 5 minutes, you know everything you need to know. Why wait? And we did. We began the dance, you know, but when I met her, the interesting thing was, for me, I immediately felt a sense of ease and comfort that I had never known. I felt the power going down to my tips. The tips of my fingers. I was a better musician. I was funnier, wittier. My abs were even flatter. I mean, you know, it's just, I was there. Now, I use the sense, the term, I had a sense of ease and comfort. I find it so interesting because when I read the doctor's opinion in the big book, I understand that. You know, I got a sense of ease and comfort from being with her that I had never known. And I pursued that to the gates of insanity and death. And I would chase that feeling and try to fix her and make so I could again reclaim that sense of ease and comfort. But we had to do a lot of dancing before we got to that point. You know, New Mexico wasn't working for her. It wasn't working for me anymore. And what do? Well, we move. So we moved up to, I had a home. We cut the lodge poles and set up my teepee on the side of Mount Hood in Oregon, and started living there. And it was an idyllic time for me. I mean, teepee's a beautiful place to live, but, rustic. But it was out in the woods, and I had a great time, and it was just her, you know, and me. And so it was neat. But again, after a couple months, it stops working. You know, that's my nature. You know, I just can't stay where I am. And it doesn't matter where I am, it's not going to last very long. And so the spring started getting tightened up again, and it wasn't working. So we moved over to Eastern Oregon, and I had my first brush with alcoholism. My sister-in-law came up, and she gave us her kids and went down to Redmond, Oregon, and proceeded to drink herself to death, I didn't understand. I mean, I had never seen anybody abuse alcohol to that extent. In our family, my parents would buy a case of bourbon and a case of scotch, and it would last a year. And it wasn't just they drinking; it was for parties. And the only person I'd ever seen abuse alcohol was me and my buddies. I didn't understand what she was doing. One Sunday she got a job as a barmaid, which is a convenient job for an alcoholic. You know, as Jennifer said, it's great. And so, I watched, you know, one Sunday she was her kids were visiting her, and she was bleeding out of slit wrists on the streets of Redmond, Oregon, and I didn't understand. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I didn't know. I'd never been taught. I'd never seen alcoholism. We took her to the hospital and then got her patched up, and I took her over to a treatment center in Bend, Oregon, 1974, and I had my first exposure to you. And they had these half sentences on the wall, easy does it, and I'm going, easy does what? But I could see that they had something that she needed, and they could talk to her in a way that I couldn't. Certainly, they knew what to say to her, and so Bobby Joe came out of this. It was a detox. They didn't have treatment centers. It was a jitter joint. So she came out, and nobody told me to go to Al-Anon. No, I mean, Al-Anon existed. It was 22, 3 years old at the time. But nobody said, you got to go to Al-Anon. I'm sure it was there. If they had told me, I wouldn't have gone, because she had a problem, not me. I'm okay. I certainly wasn't ready at that time. But I'd sit down with Bobby Joe, and we'd read the big book. And I absolutely loved what I saw in that book. It just hit me in a way in my spiritual search that I didn't understand. I didn't understand at all why it was hitting me. But it was an incredible book. And I went on. I thought Bobby Joe sobered up. It turned out she didn't, but I didn't know that. She went back to drinking. My wife and I moved to Oklahoma. And we got a farm. We're going to drop out and be a subsistence farmer. And it just started things started getting worse. She was drinking and drugging and I had to, I just have this need to know. I have no defense against that need to know. And I'd start looking. I'd come home and I'd see, what was in the ashtray, so I could know who had been there and what they'd been doing by which ashtray. I mean, we're detectives, and so we start looking for clues, and I start having to track her down at bars and men's houses and do things and drive-by sightings, go find out if she'd been at the bar, I had no defense, I'd keep watching. And my father-in-law, a neat guy. I mean, he trained cutting horses for a living, broke horses, and strong man and vibrant, and I used to work with him, and he disappeared, and I found him in a flop house down in Poto, Oklahoma, and again, a brush with alcoholism, he said, you gotta take me to treatment. And I saw this guy, this strong man, becoming a gray husk shell of a human. He was not in good shape. And I didn't understand again. It's alcoholism. And he said, Palmer, buy me a beer and take me to treatment. I'm going, why would I buy you a beer if I take you to detox? And he was seeing things that I didn't see. There were bugs crawling on him that I didn't see, and he needed DTs coming on, and he needed that beer. He needed that beer to get to detox. I bought him a beer and took him into detox. And again, it's bewildering for us in the family, because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand. My wife started drinking and drugging more and more, and that didn't particularly bother me. I just jumped in and did it with her. I mean, I love it in chapter 3 where it says, we drank wine, drank only beer, took a vacation, didn't take a vacation, and I did the same list because I thought that I was being a kind and loving husband. What I was really in fact doing was I'm selfish and self-centered. And if I could only make her okay, I would again sense that, have that sense of ease and comfort that comes from being with her. If I could just make her okay, I would be okay. I mean, that's the delusion for the Al-Anon that must be smashed, is that if I am either get rid of her, or if I could just straighten her out, I will be okay. And that's the great lie, I think, for me, is that for me, I was getting crazier and crazier. I'd do things, I remember one time she took a job on as a barmaid at a David Allen Coe concert at this, the Turkey Creek Saloon. It's so far back in the mountains, they had to run the electricity off Honda generators because the rural electrical co-op hadn't gotten there yet. And so, I mean, I don't know if you know Dave Allen Coe, but he attracts some outlaw kind of people, bikers and such. And I'm a wimp, but I decided I needed to be there to make sure that, you know, whatever she was doing or wasn't doing or something. So I signed up as security at this concert. I mean, I was like, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to go up to a big biker and say, excuse me, sir, would you please put your gun down? I mean, it's crazy. You know, I just got crazier and crazier. I remember one time she went off to a party at the lake and I stayed at the farm after dark, I just all of a sudden had this need to know. I had no defense against that first think. And you know, what do? She had the truck. Well, I got on my tractor. Went up over this, over these mountains and down these hairpin turns to do this sneaky drive-by sighting. But my tractor didn't have a muffler and there was no moonlight. So, I mean, you know, if I'd fallen off the mountain, that'd be it. You'd have a different speaker. But I didn't even think about that. I just had to know what was going on. So I pulled up to the lake on this sneaky drive-by sighting with no muffler, and nobody was there. Well, now, they could have been hiding out in the weeds just watching me, laughing at me. I don't know, or they could have never been there. They could have left and gone somewhere else, but I didn't see anybody, and I didn't think anymore. It was like, oh, okay, well, they're gone. So I just got back on my tractor and drove up and over the mountains and back down to the farm. I mean, you know, that's insane behavior. I remember sitting at the back of a hotel one night she was staying in over in Fort Smith, Arkansas in the middle of winter, waiting to see if she turned the lights on and went out in the middle of the night. Now, that's crazy. Who was freezing there doing this, you know, sitting out there in a truck all night while she was either partying or comfortable in bed? I don't know what she was doing, but you know, that's not sane behavior. And I was speaking one time, and this guy came up afterwards and said, yeah, I had a stalker too, and I wanted to explain it, but you don't understand. I'm not stalking him, but you know, it was. I was. And so it just got crazy. And you know, bitter fights in my home. And I didn't understand. And we went to marriage counseling, and they call it couples therapy today, I guess. But we went to marriage counseling, I have no judgment on marriage counseling, but I guarantee you that it probably works a lot more effectively if you tell them what's going on in the home. But I have this need to look good to the neighbors, and I have to maintain this facade at all costs. So I would not mention there was drugs and alcohol and violence and everything else going on because I don't want to let that facade down. So I everything's fine. Thank you very much. And they decided that I was the problem. I mean, she told me over and over again she drank because I, and then you fill in the blank. There was a raison de jour. I mean, I don't know what the reason was. Today it might be that I did A, and she said, if you hadn't have done A, I wouldn't have to get drunk. So I'd do B the next day. And she said, no, you should have done A. I mean, it doesn't matter what A and B are. It's just that I was always doing the wrong thing, and she had to get drunk. And the counselor agreed. They decided I was crazy. Well, I was, but I didn't know it. And so that didn't work. Things got worse. I've had a huge shelf filled with self-help books. And if a self-help book would have fixed it, I would have been fine. But you see, I suffer from a spiritual malady that I can't fix no matter what I do. And I tried everything I could think of to make her okay, so that if she was okay, I would be okay. My mother-in-law came down and she said, Palmer, is she drinking? No, Ma, she didn't drink. And, I've got to have that. I've got that need to look good to the neighbor. We isolate, or at least we did. If you have friends, they know what's going on in your house. And therefore, since you've got to maintain the facade, we cut off from friends, and we had fewer and fewer and fewer friends, and more isolated in our home. And we had one couple friends left, and they invited us to come over and see a movie Friday night. So we said, sure. And Friday night arrived, my wife said, no, I don't want to go. You go. I said, no, I'll stay. She said, I don't feel well. You go. And so I went, you know, I can follow directions. So we watched this movie. I have no clue what the movie was. It was one of those Freddy the 13th or I don't know. One of those movies that I didn't see the movie. I was so worried about what she was doing, if she was okay. And so I left and went home. And when I got home, there was a rifle pointed at the door. And she said, get the hell out. Don't you ever come back. I mean, what did I do? I just went to the movie. And I didn't understand, again, you know, it's alcoholism. And you can't understand it. No matter how I think about it, I can't understand it because it's just not logical. And so she chased me off to Arkansas with a gun. I was terrified. I mean, it is. It's terrifying looking down the front end of a rifle. So she was filing for divorce, and her lawyer called and told me to come in and have a conference. And so I got there 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, and she was there. And she said, Palmer, I don't know what I was thinking. I'm so sorry. Would you please come home? I need you. And you know, for the Al-Anon, that I need you is like a mainline shot for a junkie. you know, I fired my lawyer on the spot and went home. Of course I would. She needs me. You know, it never occurred to me that, I mean, a normie out there might think twice about moving home with a person who held a gun on him 2 weeks prior. That thought never occurred to me. I mean, she needs me. Why would I not go home? And so I did. But I tell you, it doesn't get better. When we're on a slide downhill, there's one way to go, and that's downhill. And we did go downhill, and it got worse. And it got worse. And I was just in despair. Just in despair. I didn't know what way to turn. And my mother-in-law came down again, and she said, Palmer, is she drinking? Is she drugging? She's acting weird. She said, you're acting weird. No, Mom, she's not drinking. She's not drugging. I think it's interesting. Our ODAT says that the alcoholic home is more easily spotted by the behaviors of the spouse than the alcoholic. And my mother-in-law spotted that behavior in me. She knew the behavior because she'd been there with my father-in-law. And she knew me. And she said, Palmer, I want to tell you a story. There was a lady who lived with a bad drunk and she came in and asked him one night, says, is there anything I can do to make you stop drinking? And he said, yeah, I believe if you'd go out and dig a dozen worms and bread them and fry them, I could eat those worms and I could stop drinking. And so she very lovingly went out and dug the worms, brought them in, breaded them and fried them and put them on a platter and brought them in to him. And he said, you eat half. So we'll go to any length. So she cut them in half and ate half. He went and got a bottle of bourbon and got drunk. And she said, she's going, why? Why? I mean, I got the worms. I ate half the worms. And he said, yeah, you ate the wrong half. I always ate the wrong half. No matter what I did, it was always wrong. I didn't know what to do. And she said, Palmer, you got to go to Al-Anon. You've got to go to Al-Anon. And my response was something like, yeah, right, or something. I had plans. You know, I had dreams. My wife said that if you're at work all the time, if you would just be home, I'll be okay. And so I came home, quit my job. That's easy to fix, and came home. But then we were broke, and I was there all the time, and that was bad, and she was, you know, it was the wrong thing to do again. So I had this plan. I'm going to go to the University of Oklahoma and get a job as a teacher so I could finish. I mean, I had a high school diploma, that's all. I had no education. And you know, because I'd been the stupid one. Why would I, you know, drop it out of college? And so I decided that, now if there's teachers in here, please understand, I was sick and deluded. But I thought that Well, I could get a job as a teacher, and, you know, I work from 9, 10 to 3 and take my summers off. It's an easy gig, and I can be home, and I'm a teacher now, so I know that's not true. But that's what I thought, so I went to the University of Oklahoma to get a job, get a degree teaching certificate. So I'd commute. It's a three-hour drive. I'd go up Monday morning early, get up at 4, and drive up to the University of Oklahoma and come back Thursday or Friday, depending on my class schedule, so that I could be home. And I did that, and one Thursday night, we had this bitter, bitter fight over the telephone, and I didn't know where to turn. I just didn't know what to do. I was out of options. I didn't know what to do, and what my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law told me came to mind. You got to go to Al-Anon. So I looked in the phone book, and I couldn't find Al-Anon in the phone book. I probably couldn't spell it. AA is easier to spell. I found AA in the phone book. And I called AA. And I thank God for fellowships like here and in Norman, Oklahoma, and other places where the family recovers together, where there's Al-Anon, AA, Al-A-Dog, Al-A-Cat, Al-A-Teen, all together. And they handed the phone to somebody, and she said, "Palmer, I think we can help you. Come in." And they met Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday in that group. And this was Thursday. So I went home to the farm and came back up Sunday. And Monday, March 5th of 1990, I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting. And the only thing I can tell you is I was home. I was home. I just was home. You know, and people met me at the door, and they shook my hand and welcomed me and brought me in. And I didn't hear very much that night. I heard the three C's: that I didn't cause it, can't cure it, and can't control it. And that was so astonishing to me. I thought that I had caused her to drink. I had been told over and over and over again that she drank because I did or didn't do something, that it was my fault. The counselor had told me it was my fault. And they said, no, she drinks because she's an alcoholic, and that's what an alcoholic does. And it's a disease. I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving. And I was relieved. I felt this sense of peace come over me. It's like, I'm okay. And I didn't hear much else, but I just remember that feeling of being safe and being loved. And I'm just forever grateful for that group. And they hugged me at the end of the meeting. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but you gotta remember, if you get an image in your mind of Charlie Manson, that's pretty much what I looked like. I was scraggly, long beard, long hair, dirty, I smelled, and I walked in that door, and these women gave me a hug and said, "Palmer, you keep coming back, we need you." Oh, well, if you need me, I guess I could put this in my schedule. So I did. I started coming back every time that room was open. And I say these women because there were no men in Al-Anon when I came in. Now, that's not true. It's only, again, through my perceiver. But there were no men in that particular group or the groups that I attended. It was only women. And I started getting this sense of terminal uniqueness. I thought, you don't really understand. My case is different. You know, I'm a guy and you're women in an alcoholic home. And one of the old-timers, thank God for old-timers, she pulled me aside, fingers in my chest, said, "Palmer, you listen for similarities, not differences." And I heard my story. You know, I heard these women telling my story. And they're a bunch of old women. I mean, you know, they were 40 years old, maybe. And younger than I am today. But, you know, thank God for these gals. And they kept hugging me. They kept telling me to come back. And they gave me a job. You know, I got the job, and like Dick, I was the ashtray washer, and I was happy to be the ashtray washer, and I was really good at it as well, and I loved that job, and it kept me there. I mean, you know, in the groups at that time, you know, even if you didn't smoke, you smoked because the air was so thick that, you know, everybody smoked. And so the ashtrays at the end of the meeting were pretty nasty, and I'd wash them. And I felt like I had to be there to wash the ashtrays. And I remember, like Dick too, that when they took me off that job, they had to tell me, well, you're being promoted to coffee cup washer, you know. And, oh, well, if you're going to give me a promotion. I mean, we had to wash coffee cups because we had China coffee cups. Now, China, they're not elegant. They were those nasty old brown ceramic mugs, but I washed them. And then I was given the job of setting up, and they gave me a key to the AA room to set up. And, you know, God, I felt so, I mean, it was an amazing feeling to be trusted in that service position of giving a key to the room. And so, I mean, you know, the Al-Anons met in the back and the A's up front and Alateens were in another room. And by the way, let me say, I am so grateful to see the Alateens here at this conference and being here. I love Alateen, and I love seeing you participate in being in recovery. So thank you for being here. I love watching you running around the conference. So, one of the things they did is they started talking about you got to get a sponsor. Got to get a sponsor. Have you got a sponsor yet? And then you know, it's like no. So one time this guy did come through, and I found out there were men in Al-Anon, and I asked him to sponsor me, and so. I tell you, sponsors do weird stuff. He'd listen to me for a couple meetings, and then he said, "Palmer, I want you to do a gratitude list." And I said, "You want me to do what? Have you not been listening to me? I mean, it's just it's bizarre." Because, well, back up a minute. You know, I had been going to Al-Anon for 3 months. Commuting back to the farm, and one night, my wife got, I don't know what was going on in her, I don't know, but it was, we were having this bitter fight, and she was standing over me with a butcher knife. I was laying on a cot, and she said, "Palmer, you've got to go to sleep sometime, and when you do, you're a dead man." And I had reached this point of despair where I just rolled over and went to sleep. I didn't care. I was in despair. Absolute utter despair. And in the morning I woke up and I realized that I had attempted suicide the night before. She was the instrument. I don't know what happened to her. Maybe she never meant it. Maybe she passed out. I don't know. But I knew that I had attempted suicide from that sense of despair. And I also realized that you know, these people in Al-Anon have been telling me, you know, I kept asking, "Do I go? Do I stay? Do I stay? Do I go? What do I do?" And they just laughed and said, or they smiled and said, "When you know, you'll know." What do you mean, "When I know, I'll know"? I woke up that morning and I knew that it was done, that it was over, and I could not stay any longer. I couldn't stay because I don't know what I was doing to my son. I don't know, I didn't know what I was doing to her. The relationship was done and I left and I was homeless. I had a truck, guitar, an extra pair of jeans and an extra shirt. That's all I had. And so I got in and the sponsor said, "I want you to do a gratitude list." I'm saying, "What do you mean you want me to do a gratitude list?" You know, and he said, "Well, I want you to go home and write one thing for which you're grateful." And so I went home and I was working on this gratitude list and I thought and thought and thought. And I spent a couple of hours trying to think of something I was grateful for because, you know, being homeless and all of this. And finally, I wrote on the gratitude list, "I'm grateful. I only have to write one damn thing on this gratitude list." And that's all I could come up with. And I wrote that and I took it back to him. I said, "Well, that's going to finish this." And he just pulled the rug right out from under me. He said, "Palmer, that's great. Now I want you to write two things." And then it was three things. And then it was five things. And after a couple of weeks of doing this exercise, I woke up to the fact one night that I was grateful. I had a truck. I had my guitar. I had an extra pair of jeans. I had an extra shirt. Nothing in my life had changed except my attitude. I had taken some action suggested by sponsorship, and the results had followed doing something that I absolutely knew would have no effect. I had contempt prior to investigation. That was an important lesson for me. You know, my sponsor tells me to do things all the time that I see no way that they're going to do any good, and yet I take the action because I know that he's been where I am and will and knows the way out. He knows the solution, and so I take the actions. I jumped into the program, and every time it was open, I was there. I went to Al-Anon meetings, I went to AA meetings, I went to big book studies, I went to literature studies. I was just, if the door was open, I was there. I fell in with some friends and was moved in on their couch, and they had, of course, they'd just come out of a halfway house from and treatment, and who else am I going to find, you know? And it was a magical time because we were reading the literature, we were studying, we were talking, we were having meetings in the morning, meetings at lunch, meetings in the afternoon, and then we'd go to meetings. And it was just, it was an amazing time. So I just did meetings. And one day I got a call from the university. They called that place, and I got home and they said, "You need to call." I said, "Why? They don't even know I live. I know you. Why would they call here?" And they, Dream said, "I don't know, but they called." And so I called the College of Education, and they said, "You've got to come in. You know, your student teaching starts in another month, and you have nothing set up." And I said, "I do. I'm doing my student teaching in Wilburton, Oklahoma, which is down by the farm, 3 hours away." And they said, "Oh, no, you can't do that." He said, "You got to fill out a whole bunch of paperwork. You've got to get it approved. You've got to make all this stuff happen, and you haven't done any of this." And I said, "I have. It's in my file." And they said, "We don't have a file on you." You know, once again, it's God doing for me what I can't do for myself. That file disappeared. Nobody ever knew what happened to it. I'd done all that paperwork. And they said, "You're going to have to do your student teaching here in Norman, Oklahoma." And we just had a guy call in who's a master teacher and didn't think he was going to be able to take a student teacher this semester, but he can. "Would you like to teach with him?" I said, yeah, I would. So, I mean, why would I want to go back by the farm? Because I'd left there, and it was done. So I did my student teaching in Norman, Oklahoma, and taught in the high school. And I'd go to meetings and go to school and go to meetings and go to school. And it was an incredible time. And I graduated from the University of Oklahoma with a teaching certificate, and I taught in the high school. Thank you. That's your clapping for you, because I certainly don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. My sponsor took me into the steps, and you know, we did the first step. Lack of power is my dilemma was not hard for me to accept. I'd managed my way into a state of homelessness. I mean, that's absolutely a no-brainer. We got to the second step, and you know, it's kind of a left-handed admission that we're insane when we're going to be restored to sanity. And I'm going, "But I'm not insane." And he said, "Well, Palmer, tell me, what was that tractor deal?" And it's like, "Oh, yeah, okay, so..." And then we got to the third step, and I knew it was coming. I'd seen it on the wall, and you can't disguise it with your HP stuff, you know, and all this. I knew you were talking about God, and I don't do God, you know, I don't do it. And so I was ready to leave. I'm not going there. I just don't do that. And my sponsor was really a wise guy. He took me into the chapter, the agnostic in the big book, and it says in there, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis is not always an easy alternative to face. And I'm sitting here doing this debate. I want to leave because you're going to talk to me about God. I'm going to go back to the farm. I mean, you know, how bad does that alcoholic thing hurt? You know, and it's like, I was doing the debate, and absolutely, it's not an easy choice for me to face. And he took me another a little bit further, and he said, "Are you willing? Do you believe, or are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself?" And that got me, because I'd look around and I'd see you guys laughing and having fun and, you know, lugging and hugging and scratching and having, you know, laughing and doing all this stuff. And I wanted what you have. And I didn't want what I had. And so I said, I guess I'm willing. And he said, that's all you need. So we knelt down on the floor and held hands, which I thought was a little excessive, but and said the third step prayer. I love that prayer. I love that prayer. And so we got up and he made me jump immediately into this fourth step. And I found out, you know, the first three columns are real easy to write. You know, I'm resentful at everybody and anybody who ever breathed air, I'm resentful for and feel guilty because I'm breathing your air. And I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And then that was real easy. But then we turn the page over there and it says, looking at your list again, are we ready to look at it from an entirely different perspective? Where were you wrong? It's like, oof. I didn't want to look at that, but I did. And I looked at it and I found out that every time we'd had a fight with my wife, my mouth had been flapping. I found out that I had a great part in that relationship going down and that I had indeed been wrong in a lot of different places. And it was an amazing journey for me to look at my character defects. Everybody that I resented on earth and all these institutions came down to my character defects. You know, I was no longer a victim. And I thank God for not being a victim because, you know, if she's my problem, it's helpless, hopeless, it will never get better. If I'm my problem, there's a solution. And that's what I came to in the fourth step. And I'm so grateful for that. And then he wanted to do a fifth step, and I didn't want to. I knew that if I really admitted to him everything that I am and everything that's inside me, that you guys would reconsider and say, well, Palmer, we had this secret meeting. And you know, no, you're too sick to be part of us. And we don't want you here. You know, go away. And he didn't. He laughed and he said, yeah, I did that too. You should have seen what I did. And after we're done, he said, Palmer, I love you. And you know, it's just an amazing, remarkable experience for me to have someone say, I love you. And after seeing all of my raw meat, everything that was wrong with me. And it was just amazing. And I got to he took me into the sixth and seventh step. And I love the seventh step prayer. You know, it says in the seventh step prayer, as you know, my creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. My creator. You know, if God is my creator, there's a reading in the Alateen, A Day at a Time, the red book that says, I know I'm okay because God doesn't make junk. And God's my creator. For the first time in my life, I started to get the sense that maybe I was just one of God's kids. And that I was okay just like I was. And I was in a room with about 12 people and I noticed that something was wrong. And I stepped aside to look inside and see what it is that was wrong. And what was wrong wasn't wrong at all. It was an experience. It was something I had never experienced. I was comfortable with you and I was carrying on a conversation with 12 people. I'd never experienced that. And it was a gift of the sixth and seventh step for me. My sponsor at that time graduated. And he left. I don't know where he went. To this day, I don't know where he is. Maybe he went back out drinking because he was also an alcoholic. I don't know. But I decided at that time that, you know, I've been around here for a few years. I can probably sponsor myself. I know what's going on. I got this rocking, you know. And so I began this with this new sponsorship relationship. And I tell you, it's a great gig because, you know, if I wanted to not go to a meeting some particular night and want to watch TV and I'd talk over to my sponsor would say, well, sure, you do that. You watch a meeting. You watch that movie. Or resentments are great because I'd get this resentment and I'd talk to my sponsor and my sponsor would say, well, you should feel that. You earn that. And I began to get sicker and sicker again, and I thank God I realized it. And I found another guy and asked him to sponsor me, and he said, yeah. And so we began the deal again, step one, and going back through the steps. And I started at this time dating another gal. And she was an earth person. You know, she didn't understand my need for Al-Anon, but that's cool. Whatever you want to do, that's okay. And so I'd go to Al-Anon and I was dating her, and we did do a courtship, and after about a year, we got married. And I noticed on our honeymoon, you know, that she was drinking a lot. My God. I'd never seen her drink before. Well, one time when we were dating, she had been thoughtlessly overserved one time. But I didn't know. And so I watched as we were newlyweds, she started drinking more and more and started not being able to stop. And I was at the Canyon Conference. I go back to Oklahoma every year for the Canyon Conference. And I was down in the canyon sitting with my grand sponsor, Pat Clater. And I said, "Pat, I think I've done it again. I've married another alcoholic." And Pat got the most beautiful smile on her face, and she patted on me and said, "You know, hon, sometimes I think their horns just fit the holes in our head." And you know what she was telling me is, "Palmer, you're an Al-Anon. You know, what we do is we love alcoholics. And it's okay. You keep coming back. You're in the right place." And I had indeed married another alcoholic. And she started drinking alcoholically. She started blackout drinking. And I watched her, you know, that says that in the book that there comes a point where they have no defense against the first drink, and I watched that, and she did indeed have no defense. She would in the morning say, "I will never drink again. I promise, you know, and I'd swear to God I will never drink again," and that evening she was struck drunk. And you know, I could understand that now. I could see alcoholism. I've done alcoholism with me having a program and with me not having a program. And I guarantee you it is easier going to meetings and doing the program living around alcoholism. I experienced it from both sides. And so my wife started drinking, and she was a bad drunk, could not stop. And I just go to meetings, and I'd practice the principles. I'd find her half naked drunk in the backyard, and I'd just cover up with a blanket. You know, she'd passed out, and I'd go to bed. You know, I didn't have to carry her up and fix her. I just, you know, let her stay there, and that was okay. I kept doing the steps. I kept working, and about that time I was offered. The University of Oklahoma offered me a trip to go to graduate school, a full ride. They were going to pay me to go to graduate school and study. And I'm sitting here doing this debate. You know, I was in my late 30s, and I said, "You know, man, I'm too old. I can't go to graduate school." And I heard this guy, Clint Hodges. He's not with us anymore, but he's an AA speaker. I just love Clint. He was offered a trip to law school. And he went to his sponsor and said, "Do you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school?" And Clancy looked at him and said, "Well, Clint, tell me something. How old will you be in 4 years if you don't go to law school?" You know, thank God for sponsorship. I'd never thought of that myself. So I accepted an offer to go to graduate school. And so I went to school. I'd whine some, call my sponsor, "And you know what, they want me to write a book to get out of here." And he'd say, "Well, have you written the first page yet?" "Well, no." So, you know, thank God for sponsorship. I wouldn't have thought of that. I was freaked out by page 250, and I hadn't even started page one yet. And I started going to class one day at a time. Taking one test at a time, doing one project at a time, doing the deal and going to meetings. And I remember one time I was supposed to go down to Lawton, Oklahoma. My sponsor, grand sponsor, and great grand sponsor were doing a book study. And I said, "Well, I can't go, Steve. I've got to work on my dissertation this weekend." And he said, "Palmer, how much have you written yet?" And I said, "Well, I haven't really started yet." He said, "Well, I think you can take this weekend, come to a book study." And I did. And thank God I did. You know, I'm grateful for sponsorship, because he told me, "No, you're not going to work this weekend. You're going to be at this meeting. Get in the car." You know, I need that kind of sponsorship sometimes, because my best thinking puts me not in recovery. So, you know, I worked all the way through there, and my wife drank, and I worked, and she drank. I came home one day, and she wasn't there, and my dog actually took me up the stairs. She wouldn't let me go anywhere else in the house. She took me upstairs, a little miniature schnauzer. And the bathroom door was locked and closed. I had to do the karate thing, kick the door down, and she was passed out, almost dead from a mixture of alcohol and drugs, you know, called the paramedics, and they came and took her to the hospital, you know. She was on a breathing machine. And I called you. I called my sponsor. I called my group. And they were sitting there loving me and rocking me. We didn't know if she'd live or die. And I was okay. You know, I'm not unmoved, but I was okay. I was loved. I was among my tribe. And, you know, thank God for you. That's such a contrast for me. When I was living in the commune, we were sitting around like hippies do, talking about love, and we love you. And in a moment of weakness or honesty or something, I said, you know, I don't feel it. I don't feel loved. And they literally picked me up and started rocking me horizontally and trying to make me feel loved. And I was alone and lonesome and apart from. You know, something in me was broken when I came in. I couldn't experience and feel love or I couldn't feel your love. I couldn't love you. I was just locked in self. And somewhere through the process of the steps, that was fixed. I was doing weird stuff like gratitude lists and inventories and washing ashtrays. And while I wasn't looking, that was fixed because I was in the hospital room and I knew I was loved. And I loved you. What a gift. What a gift. My sponsor, of course, made me do the eighth and ninth step, and I had a lot of amends. You know, I had hurt, as an Al-Anon, I had hurt and caused a lot of people spiritual harm, and I had to look at that, and I had to make amends to my first wife, you know, for the damage I'd done. And I did. And I came up with, you know, my mom was on the list. I'd walked off and left her dying of cancer. And how do you fix that? She's dead. Again, Clint Hodges, I heard him talking about writing a letter and going to the grave in Billings, Montana and making amends to his mom. And my sponsor directed me to do that letter. He'd heard Clint too, I guess. So I wrote a letter and flew out to Los Alamos or Albuquerque and drove up Los Alamos and went down to the cemetery and I was reading this letter to mom and I sat for a long time with her and cried and cleaned up on the graveside and just sat a long time with her. I came up out of the grave. I had contempt prior to investigation. You know, I thought, yeah, right, this is going to work, you know, right, Steve. But I took the action. When I came up out of the cemetery, the first person I ran into was my mom's dearest friend. And she said, Palmer, what were you doing today? And I said, I was just hanging out, Becky. She said, no, Palmer, really, what were you doing today? And I said, well, I went to the cemetery, Becky. She said, Palmer, what were you doing today? I mean, her question was bizarre. She was drilling, and she would not take no for an answer. And I said, well, Becky, I abandoned mom when she was dying of cancer, and I had to go down and make amends for my behavior. And I was down making amends to mom. And Becky started laughing. That's not what I expected. But she was laughing. She said, Palmer, I was with your mom the day you left. And she was overjoyed that you left because she did not want you to see her dying of cancer. And she was so grateful that you'd gone to Virginia Beach. I don't know what the odds are that the first person I'm going to run into after making amends that I didn't think were going to work was going to take me off the hook of guilt that I'd laid in for 30 years, and it was gone. In that moment, taking that action, it had relieved me of that guilt. Yes, you can make amends to people who have died. I've experienced it. You know, I know today that God is real, that God takes that and does for me what I cannot do for myself. I just know that to be true. I was, I was speaking at an Al-Anon meeting, 4 or 5 years ago, and this lady came up afterwards and said, yeah, you're one of those God Squad people. And although she didn't mean it as a compliment, I said, well, thank you. I think that talks about the power of these steps, because I went from the guy saying, oh, no, I don't do this God stuff. Don't do God stuff, to where I'm part of the God Squad today. And I know, I have daily experience that God is alive and well and working. I mean, we're a people of dead, you know, a room full of dead people here, who are alive only through the intervention of God. I love this fellowship. I just love this fellowship. You know, and my wife went into, she went into AA right after coming off the breathing machine and stayed sober for about a year. And something happened in life and she started drinking again. And indeed the disease progresses, because within 3-4 weeks she was on the breathing machine again. And I didn't know if she was going to live or die. And she did live, and she couldn't sober up. She kept drinking. And I finished up my dissertation, and I was kicked out of the University of Oklahoma with a PhD in chemistry. You know, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you go from the homeless guy on the street you're clapping for you and for the steps and the power of this program, the power of God, because there is no road to go from that homeless person that I was to being a PhD in chemistry. It doesn't happen. I cannot make that happen. But Tom Ivester says that when God has plans, the walls come down. And I think that's true. You know, God had need of a chemistry professor in Florida. And it doesn't mean that I didn't do my part. I did, but I can't make that happen. That's God working. And so I got an offer for a job in Florida, and we moved to Florida. I'm on the faculty of a university in Miami. And I love what I do. One of my defects of character is I'm a caretaker. And it caused me great misery trying to take care of people who didn't want to be cared for. Today, I was given a job. You know, God didn't remove that from me. He just gave me a job as a caretaker. I take care of God's kids all day, and that's all I do. I am so grateful. And I am effective in that job, because I think in God's hands, our defects become our greatest assets. The state of Florida thinks I work for them. I really don't. I just go to work every day for God. What can I do? You know, lead me where you need me today, God. My wife, she had a hard time. She could not get sober. And she tried and tried. She laughs and she says she has enough white chips to tile the bathroom floor. And she does. She was a slipper. But one Thanksgiving, we were cooking and dinner with our kids down for Thanksgiving. And she got drunk, passed out, and burned part of the dinner. And I worked on dinner and called my sponsor because I had a resentment. And we got that taken care of, and I put dinner on the table. And she came stumbling in and tried to work eat a little with us. But, you know, after a big drunk like that, there's not eating's probably not top on the list. And not long after that, she sobered up. And we were speaking at a meeting as a couple in recovery. And she told this story of one Thanksgiving. She burned the turkey, and she felt such shame that that was indeed her bottom, and she was able to go with a vigor that she did not know she could in AA. I think it's so interesting, because the event that I perceived as something, it was almost a two-sponsor call. I had such resentment. How dare she get drunk on Thanksgiving? This was the event I had prayed for. This was the event that caused her to surrender and sober up. You know, breathing machine, not so much. Burnt turkey, okay, you know. God is so smart about this. You know, when I think something's bad for me, often it turns out to be the most amazing event for me. And when I think it's good for me, it's bad for me. I just don't know what's right for me today. And I know that today, and I'm grateful for that. So I'm pretty much, you know, God's in charge here, and I just kind of have to let it unfold and see what's going to happen for today. My son, You know, I had left him too at the farm, and I've made amends to him, you know, on continuously. He found out at one point that he went to get the mail, he found my child support check there. He'd been told that I didn't send child support and that I'd abandoned him, and all the letters that I sent he didn't receive, and he found that in that one moment, because I was doing what was the next right thing, sending my check, he found out that I'd never left. And he called me, and we developed a relationship, went and played golf together, and he and I had a great relationship. He called me from Florida, and he'd gotten married, and then I got to go over there and bless the arrival of my granddaughter, and then, you know, with my wife, my son, his wife, and my ex-wife, and then, his mom. And then, you know, Al-Anon has put that family back together. I certainly have not the power to do that. And today, you know, we're an amazing family. I just got back from Orlando. We went up to business. My son's been serving in Afghanistan, and he just got back from a tour of duty. He's a medic in the Army. That relationship has been healed. And it's just from taking the actions, whether I believe they're going to work or not. My life today is just amazing. You know, my wife and I have, she's got 13 years of sobriety now. We have AA and Al-Anon in our home. And I'm really grateful to my wife today because, you know, she's at home taking care of the dog so that I can come and be with you. And what a gift that is from her. So, and I couldn't do that without, you know, her support. And she sends me on, go do your thing, you know. And she laughs. She says, I'm the black belt Al-Anon, you know, around. They find me amusing because I know more about the Big Book than a lot of the AAs do. But I do. I mean, I love this program. It has literally saved my life and continues to do that. I was at a funeral for the father of a really dear friend of mine. This was quite a few years ago, and the minister was talking about grace. And I had no clue what grace was. I got out, and I just didn't know. I had to go look it up, and I went to a piece of non-conference-approved literature, the Webster's Dictionary. Not a great spiritual well, but it was what I had at the time. And it says that grace is unmerited divine assistance given man for his regeneration or sanctification. I know that I did nothing to earn this life. It's not something that I earn and others don't. It's like a radio signal that anybody can get. They just have to tune the dial. And my doing the inventory and the gratitude list and all this other bizarre stuff is me fine-tuning that dial. Until I could receive a signal. And so I didn't have any problem with the regeneration. I've been made anew, and you have made me into a new person. And indeed, I didn't understand sanctification, so I'd looked that up in the dictionary also. And it says to be set free. What was I set free from? I was freed from the bondage of self. What an amazing gift that you have given me. God works through you because I need God in human skin, and you for me are giving me what God is doing. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for my life. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.